The Things We All Carry is a podcast about first responders and their stories surrounding trauma on the job. The intention of this podcast is to raise awareness and share meaningful conversation around a subject often viewed as taboo or simply ignored. Be aware this content may be graphic and it is real. It may not be suitable for children or adults triggered by this subject matter.
Welcome back to The Things We All Carry. And welcome back to my second attempt at trying to record an intro. I recorded what I thought was a pretty decent intro this morning. I went to edit it and put it into the show and package the show this afternoon, and it was gone. I didn't have it. And so I'm kicking myself because I didn't do what I normally do, which is record in two spots. I only tried to record in one, and it bit me in the ass this time. And I really do regret it because I spoke quite a bit about, you know, leaving the fire service, and it was an emotional introduction to the show. And you can never recapture that moment. You can never recapture emotion. If you miss it, you miss it. And so this is going to be a little different, but hopefully I can relay the same sentiments. This is my first show after leaving the fire service. Last Thursday was my last day, my last shift. And I didn't even get to work the entire shift. I only worked half of it. It was a hell of a ride. The 10 years, you know, each assignment, just Thursday alone was a hell of a ride. And we really didn't do anything call-wise. I got to ride the truck for my last day, which is normal. That's where I rode. But it was, you know, it's this ceremonial thing in my head of, all right, this is the last time I'm doing this. And everything that I did there was, that was it. It was the last time. And I had texted my crew the night before, and I kind of thanked them and kind of warned them, you know, hey, tomorrow's going to be an emotional day for me. And bear with me if I don't have the words or anything. I don't have a long speech at the end of the day. It's not because I didn't have the feelings, the emotions, the words. It's just that I didn't have the ability to form them into any kind of intelligible conversation or a presentation. And I made it through most of the day until we got to the end. You know, for dinner, we went over to my old station. So I had my last two crews all together. You know, I had about 25 people sitting around eating a pretty good steak dinner and just doing what we do. And for those of you who have been in a firehouse for dinner or lunch or whatever, you know what that's like. Everybody's talking. There's a lot going on. You've got 25, however many voices going at once. You're trying to follow each strand of conversation. You're trying to join in here and there, and you're keeping your primary conversation. And it can be overwhelming, but it's a blast. If I could do the fire service all over again, I'd still want to do it in big houses. Give me the more the merrier in those houses. Yeah, it gets to be overwhelming at times, but Jesus Christ, it is entertaining. You know, you have this wide cast of personalities and beliefs and experiences, and you find out that you learn from everybody. And so it's amazing. It is one hell of an environment. But back to that night, I had held it together most of the day. And, you know, I got emotional a couple times as I'm trying to figure out my gear and equipment and sort through everything and decide, you know, what I'm taking with, what I'm leaving behind. But we got to dinner, and I knew that it wasn't going to be long before emotions got the best of me. And we sat down to a good dinner, and we sat down to great conversation and just camaraderie. And, you know, we got to towards the end of dinner, and two of my good friends got put on a call, and we got quick pictures as they were headed out the door. And I know those guys. I'm not losing touch with those guys. They're two of them, what I consider two of my best friends that I've earned along the way. Then we got to the quiet time after dinner, and we knew that we were wrapping up. You know, it was time to go. And I knew that at that point, there was about an hour left in my illustrious fire service career. And we were sitting there hanging out, and we took some pictures with my old rescue crew, and the hug started, you know, the actual goodbye started, and it hit me like a baseball bat that was it, that it was it. I wasn't coming back there, you know, maybe as a visitor, but it's not the same thing coming back as a visitor, you know, ringing the doorbell to come inside someplace that you called home for a while. It's not the same thing. And I made it right until the time the hug started. And when there's something about physical contact, and when it touches you and you're charged emotionally, that it kind of just says it's okay. You know, that contact kind of says you're safe. It's okay to let some emotion out. And I definitely did that night. These guys that I ran with for some of them for a few years had become family, and definitely, you know, friends, family, whatever that definition is, they're in my life. They made an impact. They were with me through some tough times. A couple of them literally saved my life. So to say goodbye is tough. Made even tougher by these friends, these badass firefighters saying, "I love you, man. We'll miss you. We love you." It was so heartwarming and so wrenching at the same time. You know, the hugs were a little longer, a little stronger. We said our words, and I kind of forced myself to leave. You know, we had to get on the truck. We had to get back to my station. And then realization hits me that I have to do all that over again with my present crew. I was like, fuck, this is taxing, and it's exhausting, but it's well worth it. We got back to the station, and the engine was out and the medic was out. And I thought to myself, man, what a perfect time for a modified Irish exit. Just, say goodbye to that crew that was with on the truck with me and get out the door. But I knew I couldn't do that. I couldn't leave those guys hanging, especially the engine crew. They, you know, not to take away from the medic crew at all, but the engine crew was a couple of guys that, mean a lot to me. So there I waited. I staged my stuff so I could make a quick exit at that time, you know, saying my goodbyes, you know, because in my head, I'm like, oh, I just get these goodbyes out of the way and get out of here and get going and step into this great unknown. Well, that's a bunch of bullshit. You don't just say quick goodbyes when you're ending a career. Again, I was good until the physical contact. And, yeah, it was that first hug at again, and he knows what he did. John Michael knows what he did. He held me, a little longer than I wanted. And I kind of tried to end the hug and he kept it. And I had to laugh, but I was laughing through some more tears, you know. It was that straw that broke the camel's back, and the emotions came out again. I could barely murmur words to these guys as I was trying to say goodbye. And that's what I warned them about the day before, that just because I might not get the words out doesn't mean that they're not there. And I'm still trying to process those words in my head. But the hugs were doled out. And all the same things, you know, stay in touch, as I love you, you know, take care, me telling them to be safe, because that's a massive fear. This stepping away, one of the biggest fears that I have is that somehow One of those guys that I consider family gets hurt or gets killed, and I'm not there. And I know it's not rational, because we can't be there all the time, but I don't want to let those people down. And if something were to happen after I leave, it it kind of felt like I would be letting somebody down. So I get through my goodbyes and I think I'm off the hook. I grab my stuff and I go outside to get in the car and I see the rookie. He's filling up the medic unit. So I want to take a minute with him because one of the things I've noticed about him, and well, he's a good guy. He just seems reserved. He's not putting himself out there. And I know why, because you put yourself out in a big house and you're inevitably going to get made fun of. But I wanted him to know that getting made fun of and putting yourself out there, making yourself vulnerable with these guys that you're going to call family, that you one day will be maybe a hand reaching to you in a bad situation to pull you out of something. To make yourself vulnerable to them now is the most important part, you know, not only for that reason, but just to embrace and immerse yourself in the entire experience of being a firefighter or a first responder or whatever that profession is you want to call it. And I just wanted to give him a couple of words. Open yourself up, be vulnerable, enjoy this experience, take the entire ride. Don't try and shortchange yourself. And I would say that to everybody, anybody that's in the service or in a position like that, be vulnerable, take the ride, enjoy every minute of it. So I got that out and I think that's it. I'm done. I go get in the car and drive off into the sunset, which was literally, well, it was dark by then, but we'll call it sunset. And then, Nick comes out and destroys me again. You know, this is somebody that I had, I to be quite honest, I didn't know how the relationship was going to work when I found out we were going to work together, but I've come to not only appreciate, but thrive off of that friendship. And so he comes out and he says, "One more time," wraps me up, gives me a hug, and pretty much cinches it that emotionally, I was spent that night. I was tapped out with emotion. And I don't know what I expected for my last day, but I think that exceeded it. And it was a painful, emotional day, but I wouldn't miss it for anything. This nearly 11-year ride that I've taken has been amazing. And I can only hope that the next 10, 20 years of my life can approach the quality of what I've done for the last 10 years. There's a lot of hyperbole that I can spit about the fire service, but it has its faults. It has its pluses. But it's one hell of a ride. It's fascinating. It's fast. It's confusing. It's enthralling. It's all of those things. And it's an amazing career. And while there's so many things we can change about the fire service to make it better for all of us, there's so much right about it too. And I don't want to take away or discount any of that. It's an amazing community. It needs some refreshing. It needs some repair. It might actually need some grounding if that makes sense. But I would not exchange the time I spent in the fire service for anything else. It was one hell of an experience. And I have so many people to thank for that. And it's something that I can only do on an individual basis. There've been so many people instrumental in how my career played out that I couldn't do it justice on the microphone right here. It's something I have to do when I see people. So that's it. I'm done. I'm a retired firefighter, and we can fight over that word retired. I'm okay with that. I'm out. I am former firefighter, retired firefighter, ex-firefighter, whatever you want to call it. I am a entrepreneur, podcaster. We'll go with that now. And I am so pleased to have you guys along for the ride. I'm amazed that I'm able to say that this is episode 108 of The Things We All Carry. And this one was a good one. And I say that about all of them, I think. But I sat down with Jason Warren, and Jason is basically the owner operator of Mindfulness Medic. And he describes Mindfulness Medic as a lifestyle, a mindset, and wellness brand. Guess check him out. He's an interesting person. He is a cerebral conversation, and I appreciate that. I appreciate it so very much. This is a man who took what he started to see and experience as such negatives and started applying his six pillars to his life. And he made a complete transformation. He got fit after being obese. He fixed his mindset, or he knows how to work with his mindset. He took charge of his life. You know, he was letting life take charge of him, I think. And at some point he got fed up and he said, enough is enough. I'm going to be responsible for me. I'm going to make the changes I need to make for me, for my wife, for my kids. And just, you know, in general, he's so much better off today than he was, you know, those years ago when he was overweight and out of touch with family life. He's been in fire and EMS for 11 years. He's, as I mentioned, he's a husband and he's a father of two. He's up there in New Hampshire, and he's my go-to for some things, especially ice baths or some of these six pillars are fascinating. So we spend a lot of time talking about the six pillars. We touch on his experience in the fire service, and we don't glorify too much. We talk about a call or two, but we really just talk about how he made the change and why he made the change and how you can make the change if you're looking for that opportunity. So I hope this show is valuable to you. I hope you find benefit in it. And I would love to hear your comments, your criticisms, or just reach out and say hi. I'm going to need some friends because I lost a chunk of my life there, you know. It's kind of a joke, but I do like the contact with you guys. So reach out to me. You can find me on Instagram or TikTok at The Things We All Carry, or you can email me, stack@thethingsweallcarry.com. So without further ado, please sit back and enjoy episode 108 with Jason Warren. A quick reminder to please help us build a community which not only recognizes, but supports each other through the struggles and recovery. Reach out through Instagram @thethingsweallcarry or email mystory@thethingsweallcarry.com to offer support and share your story. Please remember to leave a review on iTunes and give a shout out to any first responder you know, love, or care about. Y'all enjoy the show. If you're comfortable, let me pull those notes up again and let's just have our conversation and see where we go today.
Good.
All right. Welcome back to The Things We All Carry. Today I have Jason Warren with me. Jason he's out of New Hampshire. He's been firing EMS for about 11 years. He is the owner of Mindfulness Medic, which is a pretty interesting, it's not only an interesting website, it's an interesting concept. He defines it as a lifestyle, mindset, and wellness brand. And I'll let him talk more about it because I can't do it the justice that he will as the owner of it. Jason's a husband and a father of two, and he's in New Hampshire with us this morning. And I'd like to say good morning and thank you for joining me.
Good morning, Stack. Thanks for having me. Appreciate being here.
Let's talk music because I need to know the last song you listened to. And I have a feeling this one could be interesting.
Oh, the last song I listened to. Man, I have eclectic music tastes. Everything from like metalcore to like Buddhist Zen music.
This is why I thought it would be interesting.
No joke. I'll listen to like some really hardcore deathcore stuff, and then the next minute I'll be listening to 45 minutes of like Om chants. So pretty eclectic taste in music.
All right. Yeah. So what was the last one then?
Deepest Om right there.
Okay.
I was using that to chill out this morning.
Cool.
I like it. Meditation, but.
And the reason I do that is because music is one of those things that I take with me wherever I go. And I'm always looking for something new. And even if it's, that's perfect because there are times where I just need to regulate myself, and that's a perfect thing to do it with. So I appreciate that. So, all right. Did you work last night?
No, I've been on my 4-day stretch, thankfully.
All right.
We do like the the typical standard fire department schedule.
Yeah,
24 on, 48 off, which are like your covered days. You can get mandated 24 on, and then we get 4 days off.
All right, cool. So you're kind of fresh. I'm kind of fresh. Let's see where this goes.
Good.
So born and raised in New Hampshire?
Yeah, born and raised in New Hampshire, born in Concord, New Hampshire, which is ironically where I work now. The department I'm on, the fire department. Lived in New Hampshire most of my life. Did a short stint in Arizona when I was younger, then moved back. That kind of ties into my whole childhood history and the stuff I'm sure we'll talk about in a little while as far as the ACEs score and stuff that you've mentioned before on the podcast.
So what was family life like growing up?
Family life, I mean, was pretty standard for a while. I mean, pretty uneventful up into a certain point, I guess, until it wasn't, and then started to experience a lot of darkness in my childhood, which I think led to kind of the place I was at a few years ago and currently today. But I'm also healing through a lot of that stuff now. There was a point where, you know, I dealt with a lot of bullying, physical and emotional and psychological, when I was a kid. Went through a lot of darkness there. And a lot of this stuff is stuff I've been healing through and integrating through recently through therapy. And it's kind of amazing to me because I'm able to like sit here and talk about it for the first time in my whole life. This was stuff that I wasn't comfortable even mentioning to people beyond like my wife, you know, people who are really close. But I think it's an important conversation to have. People who are first responders, firefighters, paramedics, EMTs, cops, you know, we all seem to have this common thread I've found through a lot of us having experienced some sort of adverse childhood events or childhood trauma. And I think I'm coming to believe that, you know, we're drawn to this career in a sense because we want to alleviate that pain and suffering that we experienced, or you know, we're trying to mitigate that chaos in life because it's just kind of what we are used to. That weird essence that we found normalcy in chaos during our childhood. And there's a statistic, something like most first responders have an ACE score of at least 4. I did my test. I'm a 7.
Yeah. So let's break that down a little bit. And you and I are going to be lay people talking about it, but go tell me what the ACE score is.
Yeah. So, and obviously I'm not trained as like a therapist or psychologist when it comes to it, but the ACE score is it's an acronym that stands for Adverse Childhood Events. It's a test that you take. It has a series of questions and it's a 1 through 10 score. 0 being obviously no childhood adverse events and 10 being the absolute worst. And it's a metric used to kind of gauge people's long-term health effects that they're going to have from these traumas. And you know, their ability to navigate life later on in adulthood. And it's said that most first responders have at least a 4, and 4 is considered like really bad.
Yeah.
Per this test. And when I did it, I was a 7. So.
And so what I did was I pulled up a site that gives you the questions and I'm not going to go through, I'll read them all. I don't care. It's not like I'm taking the test. Did a parent or other adult in the household often or very often swear, insult, put you down, humiliate you, act in a way that made you afraid? Did a parent or other adult in the household push, grab, slap, throw something at you, ever hit you so hard marks were made? Same thing, a person or adult 5 years older and you touch, fondle, or sexually, or attempt to have oral, anal, vaginal intercourse with you. So it goes on and on. There's all these things that obviously children should not be going through, should not be experiencing. And yeah, a lot of us have had, like you said, 4, 5, 6, 7 of these things occur in our lives.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a common thread. And I think it's interesting. And, you know, I've heard other guests on your podcast talk about how, you know, it should be normalized to discuss this stuff in our career fields and in our cultures. And it's also hard because, you know, if you go into these careers with these pre-existing conditions, as they could call it, it could take away your availability to certain resources or benefits. You know, that's kind of that sticky area where people get kind of caught up and afraid and opening up and talking about this stuff. know, especially about the first responder, mental health stuff, PTSD, suicidal thoughts, you know, the ideations and all that.
You know, it's ironic because I guess I've never put that together in my head. For some reason, it's one of these things that just kind of hit me as you and I are talking right now. And it's that, you know, we go through these ACE scores or you go through these adverse childhood experiences and you're kind of taught not to talk about it as a kid because whoever's doing it to you is telling you, hey, this is our secret or don't tell anybody or, you know, you'll get in trouble if you let anybody know. And so then, yeah, fuck yeah, of course that translates to adulthood. Of course we're not going to then be open to talking about anything else. Why would we? We were taught from the get-go that it wasn't the thing you talked about.
Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of shame and guilt that's carried on through people's lives about it. They don't want to open up and talk about it.
So how do you end up in the fire service?
Well, I'll just finish off that whole childhood experience because I think that kind of ties into it, you know, so just go through all that darkness, that psychological and emotional bullying a lot, sexually molested as a child by an older kid, an older boy. And, you know, he kind of beat the crap out of me and threatened me with death if I ever told anyone. And that was something I had never even opened up about with anyone up until recently. And again, that's because I got into therapy.
Yeah.
A few months ago, and I started integrating some of this stuff and healing through it to the point where I'm able to just sit here and talk about it. So went through that, moved around to 7 different schools between the ages of kindergarten and 4th grade. So always found it hard and difficult to make friends, fit in with the social circles. Moved out to Arizona again because my parents were chasing the happiness and chasing the careers. I grew up in a law enforcement family. My dad was a cop, 38 years. So I grew up in that structured system. Mm-hmm. You know, he was always busy working, which we get it, right? We work busy schedules. We're trying to provide for our families. The pay isn't always that great. So we have to work a lot of overtime often to make ends meet.
Right.
You know, so I grew up in that family where dad wasn't always home. He wasn't always available. Tough. I had to find my own way. So we ended up in Arizona and just, again, went to 3 different schools out there in the period of a couple years. Found it difficult to, you know, fit in, make friends. There was one point, there's this school, one of the schools I went to. First day there, I walk up to the soccer field because at the time I played soccer. So it was like my one little gateway into trying to, you know, fit in with these kids. I walk up to the field, just kind of standing there waiting to be, you know, welcomed into their group. And I just feel this sharp crack on the side of my head. I collapsed to the ground and I woke up with tears in my eyes and there was a kid standing over me. He just sucker punched me in the side of the head for no reason. So it was just like all these random exposures to violence and, you know, threats of being killed near a kid. Just growing up in an environment not feeling safe, not feeling very welcomed, you know, feeling kind of powerless.
Yeah.
Frequently throughout my childhood. But, you know, I pushed on through that and just kind of lived the rest of my adolescence and then moved out / kicked out when I was 17. And at that point, I was working in the, you know, the food service industry. That was my first career. And that's where I spent the majority of my young adult life was in the food service industry. You know, working my way up from being a dishwasher to eventually being the head chef of multiple restaurants, which was pretty fun. Ran a couple restaurants, got to run a cool catering company and bakery with my mother-in-law eventually down the road after I met my now current wife. And then, like a lot of people, I think I had that inner desire inside to do more with my life. And it was kind of just this weird, ambiguous void that I had that I knew I wanted to do something more. I wanted to serve in a higher level. So I make the joke that my dad was a cop, so I naturally wanted to do the opposite. So yeah. I got to the fire service just to disappoint him even more, which is my joke. So I joined my local volunteer fire department in the town I lived in with my wife and then just slowly started my career from there. I got my EMT certificate, the first go around because that was like the quick track into getting out of culinary field and into the job.
Right.
And then from there, just got my advanced EMT, then eventually went to paramedic school, worked for a hospital-based EMS system, which was like at the time my pinnacle career goal. And that's also where I started experiencing a lot of the traumatic calls in my life that really started to change the trajectory of who I am as a person, you know, and a lot of the darkness that I started to struggle with that started to affect my family, my, you know, relationship with my wife, my inability to show up as a father because of all of these things that at the time, my trauma and my victim story that I was living in wasn't, you know, I wasn't moving past that stuff.
Right. So you go hospital-based first. How long do you spend in the hospital-based system?
I was there for about 8 years.
That's a good run.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a good place to work, but it was, again, that was where it really started to change for me, you know, because we get into these careers and we have this, and at least I did, this idealistic version of what we think it's going to be like, you know, coming in and using our skills and our knowledge and our abilities to help save lives or, you know, prevent the destruction of all this property or, you know, mitigate tragedy, loss, and suffering. And you realize that you're doing less of that and you're actually just bearing witness to more of it. So
what can you point, and not to glorify everything, but are there things you can point to in that stint that you go, man, that was it. Those are the things that started stacking up for me.
Yeah. So, I mean, the one call that changed it all for me is August 2nd, 2016. And I worked night shift at the time. So I was getting the ambulance ready, going through all my equipment, doing the checks, you know, how you do at the beginning of your shift. And the tone goes out for a gunshot wound to the head. So, you know, obviously you get that dispatch information. Dispatch comes on, is like more information pending. So we start heading towards the scene. And you know, your mind starts racing at that point. You know, all the treatment modalities, all the things that you're expecting to see. You know, you're going through your game plan with your partner. So we get on scene. And at this lake in one of the surrounding towns that we covered. And there's a bunch of commotion down on this dock. So we get out and that's where the event had happened. And it ended up being a male in his about 40s who shot himself underneath the chin. But he had had respirations. He was in a shockable rhythm. So he was a viable patient at the time. And we just started working the resuscitation at the end of the dock. And it was just, again, that weird, macabre, almost like Monty Python-esque, dark, just screwed up situation, you know, where, you know, the dock's moving, people are almost falling off into the water. And it's just this really kind of twisted.
Yeah.
Twisted thing, you know, and everybody goes through those types of calls. Whereas it's like the fog of war and you don't really know what's going on. You're trying to gather all these details and it's ambiguous and you're trying to piece the puzzle together. So he had shot himself underneath the chin to the point where it transected his trachea. So we couldn't orally intubate him.
Mm-mm.
So we're going to have to do a surgical crite to maintain this guy's airway properly. Because every time we were trying to provide positive pressure ventilation to the bag mouth mask, it would just blow out the hole underneath his chin where he had shot himself. So we ended up shocking him, resuscitating him. We decided to just get him off the dock because it's not safe for anyone at this point. So we get him up, get him onto a scoop stretcher and start extracting him up the hill off the dock. And, you know, up until that point, it's like, it's a normal trauma call, like a lot of trauma calls we go on, right? We're kind of used to those types of events. It's the thing that happened that changed it for me is where I was loading him into the back of my ambulance. The little boy was standing off to the side. And he looks at me, he's, is Dad going to be okay? Being the guy's son. That was like the moment for me that really changed it all. It went from this idealistic, over-romanticized version of what being a paramedic, a firefighter, a cop is going to be. And it really just kind of illuminated to me the dark side of what this career entails. And that's witnessing shit that most people never see in their lifetime once, let alone on a repetitive, normal, pretty frequent basis. Right.
Right.
You start to see this side of humanity that most people don't see. You start to bear witness to a lot of tragedy, loss, and suffering. And I think that's what adds that heaviness to this career. Not necessarily the acute traumatic event, right? We can all deal with the imagery. I mean, it's not fun and it's not normal and it still affects us. But I think for me, at least, it was the emotional side that affected me the most. And having his son stand there and look at me and ask me if his dad was going to be okay. And that was probably one of the most heavy things that I've ever had. Just absorb. You know, you don't even know what to say to the kid at that point, right?
Yeah, no, you have no idea, because define okay, right?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't even say anything. I just looked through him, you know?
Yeah.
You just try to not even connect the emotional dots at that point, because you still have a job to do. You still have a resuscitation to try to perform to save this guy's life. So we get him to the hospital, and we are a hospital-based EMS system. So one of the cool things about our job is we bring patients in, and we'd actually get to continue the care at the hospital with the physicians and the nurses. So we were part of the resuscitation right there in the trauma bay with them. So eventually a doc calls it, because he was dead. There's no way we're going to get him back at that point. And so again, the emotional aspect is the roughest, because they'd always invite the family back after, or, you know, during the resuscitation or after. So the wife comes back and, you know, when the doc told her that there was nothing we could do, the sound that a human makes when they find out that their loved one is gone and that they're never going to see them again, it's like, if you know, you know. You, like, when you've heard that sound before, you've heard that guttural, like, blood curdling cry, you know, that sound never leaves your mind. At least it hasn't for me. So watching her collapse to the ground and just bearing that news, it's like, again, it was okay. I can deal with the acute chaos. I can deal with the mangled car wrecks, the bodies, the blood, the gore, you know, the crazy structure fire, like the chaos, right? Mm-hmm. But it's when that emotional aspect comes into it.
Yeah.
Then it's like, damn, this is heavy. And that affected me heavily at the time. And then come to find out, that guy was a cop in New York. And he had been struggling heavily with PTSD and suicidal thoughts. I came to find this information out later, because somebody in the ER ended up finding this information out from the wife. And so they had been up in the area at their vacation home on a trip up from New York to try to get away from all of the stuff they had been going through. And this guy had been struggling. And he had asked his wife on multiple occasions, hey, you got to take my duty gun away from me. I'm not feeling right in the head. And I think I might do something stupid. So lo and behold, that night, he decided to go down to the end of the dock and shoot himself with his duty pistol, because he couldn't handle the darkness anymore that he was experiencing. So that really kind of like solidified it in my mind, especially with the connection that this guy was a law enforcement officer, had a loving family. Normal people would look at that circumstance and say, you know, living a good life. Got kids and a wife that love him. He's got a good job. But he was obviously struggling with stuff inside his mind that, you know, he couldn't handle anymore. He couldn't fight anymore.
Right.
You know? And again, like this stuff has haunted me, and through my recent journey of healing and transformation and therapy, I realized like that affected me so much because I saw that little boy ask me that question in multiple versions. So I was looking at that boy asking me if his dad was going to be okay, like seeing myself asking me if my father was going to be okay. And I was also seeing that little boy as my own son asking me if I was going to be okay. And I was also seeing that little boy as my childhood version of myself asking me if my adult version of myself was going to be okay.
Yeah.
And you don't put those dots together, you know, until you go through, like I've been going through therapy and EMDR, and just like it's really been opening up a lot of doors for me. So yeah, that was like the one call that really started to open up that darkness for me. And time I was married, I had a young child. My oldest was my firstborn. He was young, little baby at that time, and I just immersed myself more and more into the job. Mm-hmm. And I think it was a defense mechanism, looking back on it.
Yeah, of course it was.
I was trying to escape a lot of the pain and the suffering that I had inside my own mind.
Mm-hmm.
By thinking that, you know, just working as much as I could and just being completely focused on my career and identifying myself 100% with my career and trying to become the best paramedic that I could and taking all the classes I could under the guise of like professional development and career development. You know, I realized it's just a defense mechanism. I was just running.
Yeah.
I was just trying to hide from the pain, you know, and I found myself surrounded in a situation where I wasn't showing up for my family. You know, there's years of my youngest son's life where I can't even remember because I was so disconnected. I was so not present. You know, I left it up to my wife to start raising our kids, and I wasn't serving my wife either. You know, I wasn't being that optimal husband that I should be. So I found myself just going deeper into that dark rabbit hole and using vices and addictions to try to console myself through heavy drinking, pornography. Had a dance with the devil with some narcotic pain medications after a couple back injuries, you know. And thankfully, I was able to get away from all that stuff. So I changed careers. I didn't change careers, but I made the jump to the fire service.
Hey guys, quick break right here just to check in and thank each of you for listening to the show. Your support has been paramount, and I appreciate all of you. I have one request, though. I need you to share the show with everyone you know. Help me get the word out and spread these stories as far and as wide as we can. While you're at it, please leave a review of the show wherever you happen to listen. Feel free to reach out to me at any time to share your story, to talk, or to pass on suggestions. Let's get on with the rest of the show.
So I've been with in the Firebase DMS system I'm with now for a year and a half. And that was after just needing to get away from that hospital-based system I was in. Just a lot of politics after the pandemic, a lot of stuff I didn't agree with. I made the jump. And you know, during that period, it was around 2019, when the whole world was collapsing, I had this like started having these epiphanies. And, you know, there was a close coworker I had, he was a partner with me on the ambulance. He ended up passing away unexpectedly. And I was away on vacation at the time. And when I came back, I heard the news of his passing. And I remember watching everyone, you know, mourn this guy's loss for a couple weeks, 3 weeks, and then everybody just moved on.
Yeah.
You know, everybody just carried on with their life like nothing had happened. And I was just really taken back by that. You know, I was looking around at my own life and just started to have this voice inside of my head telling me that I was running out of time, that I was wasting the most precious resource that I had here on earth, and that's our time. I was just blowing through it with like total disregard, developing my relationships with my family, into living that optimized life of being happy and making memories. So that's when I started down this whole transformative journey I've been on for the last couple of years. And after a while, I started noticing that there was a pattern of these things that I was using and applying to my life. And that's kind of where my six pillars came in. And that became the whole foundation of Mindfulness Medic. These six things that I noticed I was using in my life to transform myself from that person that I was, living my victim story, refusing to take accountability for my situation, being obese, depressed, anxious, PTSD, all that stuff, vices and addictions, to using these six things to leverage and mitigate against all that stuff.
That's exactly what I was going to ask you. If you could paint a pretty accurate picture of what or who Jason was before you start down this path, like, and you mentioned it, obese, the PTSD, kind of a victim mindset. Yeah. I mean, where were you in relation to, you know, like you talked about your relationship with your wife, you know, what was that like at the time?
Before you
start this transformation.
Yeah. I mean, it was hard. Because again, up until, you know, recently, I didn't realize that a lot of my own personal stuff was rooted so deeply into my childhood.
Right.
And the stuff that I experienced before the job. You know, I was just so easily quick to blame the traumatic experiences or the, you know, blame my boss or blame the schedule or blame the poor pay or just blame all of these external factors on the reason why I wasn't showing up. Or the reason why I was lazy and apathetic. And I was like, not going to all the family events. Or I was like, I was always too tired. Or I always just wanted to stay home. You know, I just got off shift. I want to sleep and take a nap. And it's like, these things that I was falling victim to. And I was not seeing it. And I wasn't putting the pieces together that it's up to me to fix that stuff. Nobody was going to come save me but myself. Like, it was nobody else's responsibility to pull me out of that situation, pull me out of that mindset. You know, so the marriage just started to become very distant. You know, my wife, she was an absolute hero. She just carried on and pressed on and was like, understood where I was coming from, but it was also like, you know what? I got to press on. I got a house to manage and kids to raise and I'm going to do it whether this guy is here or not. And, you know, it wasn't easy on her. Mm-mm. We've gone through a lot of stuff for the last year and our marriage now is better than it's ever been. So we've had a lot of talks about the past and our history and, you know, a lot of that hard stuff that I didn't even recognize was a problem, you know?
When you've started therapy and I don't want to get too far off point because I want to get into the six pillars, but when you started therapy, were you aware of how the childhood experiences ran deep for you? Or is that something that came out in therapy? Like you're thinking, oh man, I had this, I had this, I had this. Or through talk, did you go, oh shit, I forgot I had that?
I think it's a mix of both. I mean, I had, you know, the molestation thing definitely was one of my deeper, darker things. And you know, the relationship with my own father and, you know, finding out at a very early age that he wasn't my biological father and not meeting my biological father until I was 30. So there, I knew that there was all of these big underlying childhood things, but I also didn't connect the dots. They were contributing so heavily to the person that I had become.
Yeah.
It's like, I was always that typical, you know, masculine alpha guy who was like, well, I don't need therapy. I got it figured out. I got my shit under control. I have station over myself as a man, right?
Right.
I got it all figured out. Until you're like, one day you hit so rock bottom, you're like, damn, I don't have it figured out. And no matter how much of my own progress I've made in my transformation, there was still a point where couldn't carry all that weight by myself anymore.
Right.
You know, I didn't start therapy until October of this year. And that was after I started talking about my six pillars and my transformative journey and all of these things I was doing in my life. Right.
Right.
I was still not being completely honest with myself in this immense load that I still couldn't process by myself.
Right.
That I needed to reach out for help. You know, and my wife, again, I give her so much credit to all of this. She just was like, dude, gotta get into therapy.
Yeah.
Because there's all of these aspects of yourself, your childhood, that you need to work through. Like, you've reached the capacity of your ability to transform without any like further help. And it's so true. So I found this first responder focused therapy company in my state that I work in, or that I live in. And I think that's been really foundational too, because it's people who get it. Like, my therapist, he was a cop for forever. He was in the military. So he's definitely got that mindset. Mm-hmm. He understands, you know. I know a lot of people, they therapy shop because they can't find that therapist that they connect with or they mesh with. Or
dude, it can be a nightmare.
Yeah. Well, I lucked out and I found this guy. And again, the amount of stuff I've been able to do through EMDR and just talk therapy has been incredible over the last few months. So, like, therapy, I think, is just... I don't know if it's our culture. Again, it's because mental health is still, we've made so much progress, I think, in the fire service as first responders and in healthcare, where, like, we always say normalize the conversation and end the stigma.
Yeah.
You know, we're making good progress, but it's still not there 100%, right?
You know, the amazing thing is I hear that quite often, and I've had a couple of conversations with people that say, well, it's so much better. And I said, but it was so fucking bad. And so much better isn't where we need to be right now. You know, we have so much more to go.
Especially on the administrative side, right?
Yes.
I've been going through therapy, you know, out of pocket, and I'm not complaining, but what I'm saying is, why out of pocket? I mean, like, insurance and all that stuff.
Right.
But why is it not offered through departments? You know, like, why could I not go down to admin? And they're like, yeah, you have X amount of covered therapy sessions just because you're in this profession.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Why is it that if you finally get to that point where you've made that progress and you're like, all right, I'm ready, which frankly, most people don't get to because they're afraid. They're afraid of the judgment. They're afraid of the shame. They're afraid of the guilt. They're afraid of just facing that inner version of themselves to be like, yeah, I need help.
Yeah.
People that even get to that point where they're like, I need therapy. Now they have to face the roadblock of, okay, how do I get it?
Right.
Is it going to be covered? How am I going to pay for this? Now, am I going to have to work even more overtime to make, you know, all these payments, which is then just continuing the cycle of keeping me away from my family.
Yep.
Creating all of this additional stress in life. So I look around at our culture and I'm like, this should be covered. It shouldn't even be a question.
The problem is
all of these others. What's that?
The problem is if you decide to cover it financially, then you're admitting that there's a problem. And for departments and municipalities to admit that there's a problem, they're going to have to own up to it in the long run. And that means financially. And that scares the hell out of the bean counters, to use a used term.
Yeah. But then you have to ask yourself, how much is a life worth, right? I mean, we all know the answer to that.
Yeah.
We know the answer to that question because we do that every day. You know, we risk a lot to save a lot.
Yeah.
That's what we do. We realize the value of life. But why doesn't the administrations in some of these departments realize that, right? You want to talk a big game and talk about all these safety initiatives and wellness and cancer screenings. But when it comes to mental health stuff, we still have people smoking themselves at an alarming rate.
Mm-hmm.
In our profession, you know, and I always hate to play the what if question, the what if game, but I look around sometimes and I'm like, how many lives could we have saved in our own culture, our own brotherhood and sisterhood, these people had just had access to resources.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if they didn't just feel so ashamed and afraid of people's judgment, if they're like, I'm not feeling good, I got this going on. We're so afraid of judgment from other people that it'll prevent ourselves from healing.
Right. So let's talk about the six pillars. How did you, you say these were things you looked around and you said, okay, this is what I'm doing wrong, for lack of a better word, correct?
Yeah.
And then
doing wrong and just these things that I was just kind of implementing in my life.
So, yeah. So there, from that, you say, okay, this is how I want to live my life from this point forward.
So six pillars, gratitude being the first one. You know, it's such an easy thing to implement in your life. And I really started to find it through just kind of, for lack of a better term, getting into some like alternative hippie type stuff. I found Wim Hof back
in
2018, 2017, started getting to his approach and his philosophy and where he came from. You know, his wife had committed suicide and he needed to find this thing in his life that, you know, brought him back down. And hearing and reading his story about how he found that in the cold water and in breath work and in meditation really kind of like opened my eyes to a lot of that stuff. So started doing the cold shower stuff, started getting more and more into meditation and what that could do, getting into breath work. And that opened the doors to this whole gratitude thing for me. And just being grateful for those little things, those simple things in our life that we have all around us that we so easily don't even recognize because we're just so busy and preoccupied with so many things. You know, it's just waking up every day and being grateful for that opportunity again to wake up.
Yeah.
For another opportunity to experience everything that we have around us. And that dovetails into the second pillar, which is presence. And that's just trying to be present in the moment as much as possible. Presence breeds gratitude and realizing that all those past worries or, you know, future anxieties, it's just stuff we make up in our head.
Mm. Say it again. Say that part again right there. There's somebody in the back that doesn't fucking understand that yet. Say it again.
Right. So it's all just this fake worry of anticipated pain. It's worrying about the future, which doesn't exist, and worrying about the past, which is useless. No such thing as the past. It's all right now in this present moment, you know, and it's continually just flying past us every single moment. And that's where the design for the hourglass came from. Mm-hmm. It's my reminder, my daily reminder that I'm running out of time. I'm going to try to be present as much as possible.
Right.
Because I think, you know, especially as first responders, we see it firsthand. We see firsthand the fragility of life, the impermanence of life, how quickly things can be taken away from people, how people can go from living a completely normal, happy life one second to the next day losing everything that they had. So really trying to stay mindful of that and not take that for granted.
Yeah.
Being present in the moment. And then the third pillar is spirituality. And that's just a connection to a higher purpose. You know, I tell people, I don't care what you believe in, mm-hmm. as long as you believe in something, whatever you want to call that. Because that belief in something bigger than yourself, for me, it gave me purpose. It gave me something to strive towards. It gave me, started to develop that idea that I have a higher potential that I could live. You know, that getting out of that dark period in my life, taking accountability for my situation and becoming that thing that was congruent to the man that I wanted to be. That was my mission. That was heavily driven by that belief in something bigger, that I was placed here for a reason, that I wasn't just here by some sort of random circumstance, you know?
Yeah, so your spirituality then isn't necessarily a deity.
Right, it's just a generalized belief in, you know, why I'm here.
Right.
Here for a purpose. And that goes through, you know, I experienced everything in my childhood to get to this point I'm at today to be prepared. You know, it was like a training grounds.
Mm.
I experienced all of those things in order to prepare me to be the person I am today.
Yeah.
They're little tests. They're little items put in our life to see how we respond and help build us into the people we are today.
Right.
So that started to develop that aspect for me pretty heavily.
I think that when you start to speak spirituality, it in some cases people automatically start to tune out a little bit. That's why I wanted to cover that a little more in depth, because for some people it's you've said it, you started getting into some of these hippie-ish woo-woo kind of things. And for some people spirituality is hippie-ish or woo-woo. And to just say, I believe in something bigger than me, or I believe I'm bound for something bigger than what I am, that changes it to just saying spirituality. In a way, because it defines it a little better. Because for me and people have heard me talk about it, and I'm not embarrassed or ashamed to say it. I'm an atheist. I don't believe in a deity. I don't believe in something like that, but I do believe that there's a purpose for everybody. And so that makes sense in the realm of spirituality.
Right. It's a reason to get up out of bed in the morning. It's a reason to push on. It's a reason to fight forward. It's that spark, it's that fuel, it's that flame, whatever it is that gives you that purpose in life.
Right.
If we didn't have a purpose, we'd all just sit around without any reason for anything.
Yeah.
Again, I don't care if you call it God, Buddha, Jesus, whatever you want to call it. You have something bigger than yourself to fuel that desire to continually move forward. The fourth pillar being fitness. Fitness to me is mental and physical.
Mm-hmm.
I talked about being like, I was morbidly obese. I was pushing 260 pounds at one point, just completely unhealthy. My diet was trash, full of processed foods, just not living a good, healthy lifestyle at the time. And I realized that my physical form and the way I was treating my physical body had a direct relation to how I felt mentally. So I started realizing that your physical fitness and your physicality directly related to how you feel mentally.
Yeah.
So losing a lot of weight, body fat, putting on muscle, getting healthy, getting my hormones optimized, because those were all jacked up from a lot of stuff that's involved in the career we do. Started to feel a lot better mentally. All of a sudden, all this stuff that I was experiencing, depression, anxiety, all that stuff started to go away. You start to feel more confident. You feel better in yourself. Fitness is both physical and mental.
Yeah.
That continual driving to become better and more optimized helps you fight through that darkness you're experiencing. Fifth pillar is family and tribe.
Sorry, I want to go back to that. You have to. It has to affect your mentality and your emotional. Because you can't be weak in one and strong in the other. They don't coexist.
Right, it's a symbiotic relationship.
They're
both synergistic to each other. You know, they can't, like the yin and the yang. It's the balance.
Yeah. All right, interrupt you. Number five,
family tribe. So it's just that realization that family is everything we have. It's the most important thing we have, right next to our time on Earth, right?
And let's define really family too, though. I mean, because family is not just a blood thing. Family is like you said, it's your tribe. It's right. Your people. It's where you fit. It's where who fits with you.
Exactly. It's the crew at work. It's the the people you have in your life who are genuinely wanting to see you succeed.
Yeah. Win.
It's the people who you have that want to see you crush life, you know, and those are rare people to find. But when you find those people, you want to stack those people deep into your corner. It's the ones at work, our partners, the guys on shifts. Those relationships we form there, they're like a second family.
Mm.
But also, you know, the family at home, and that was the big realization I had, is that I was ignoring those ones the most.
Mm-hmm.
The people that care about me and love me the most were the ones waiting for me to come. And I was neglecting that for a long time. And realizing that just
despite the relationships I might build with some of the guys at work, nothing's going to ever compare to the ones I have at home. You know, when I'm dead and gone, or I'm retired, people are going to forget about me pretty quickly. You know, but the people that remember me in the way that I showed up or I didn't show up, those are my family, mm-hmm. my kids, my wife. So I really started to kind of like shift my perspective that, you know, I love the job and I love what I do. And you can still be super passionate about what you do. You can still try to be the best firefighter or the best paramedic that you can be. You can also realize that I prioritize family. I prioritize my time away from work.
Yeah.
No, I'm not going to work endless overtime anymore and burn my candle at both ends and have a gazillion irons in the fire to try to make ends meet, right? Because it's just sacrificing my relationship with my family. So doing those things that I could, making those moves, trying to get things dialed in so I could spend more time at home with my family. And that's where the sixth pillar comes in, is the financial freedom component.
Mm-hmm.
That without financial freedom, you're going to be tied down and kind of enslaved to needing to work all the overtime, to need to continually always be at work. You know? Because, again, I fell victim to this too. You max out credit cards, you're out buying all these things, you try to fill these voids in your life, these materialistic things. Mm. You think that thing is going to make me feel better, or this thing is going to make me feel better, and you just realize that you're digging yourself deeper and deeper.
Yeah.
Got the brand new pickup truck, or I got to go on this vacation. It's like, well, you just dial it back. You make those smart financial decisions. You invest, you save up, right? You don't go into crazy amounts of debt. You're going to be like, well, now I don't have to pick up that extra shift. I can spend more time with my family.
Yeah. And then there's a prospect for people listening who are going, all right, well, I'm already in that debt, so what do I do? And so there's so many ways to try and take care of it. And there are programs out there, and there's advice to be given and advice to be heard, but it is wise. I mean, if you're not overextending yourself, then you don't have to overextend yourself.
Right. Right. And I get it. It's hard, especially once you incur that debt, you know.
I had a talk with one of the guys at work the other day, and he was mentioning that his time in the service drove him to debt just from the get-go. And I said, yeah, because they prey on young service members. And then on the other hand, they also prey on young college students, because it automatically starts you in a world of debt and a life of debt. And that's where people, you know, let's go with corporations, we'll make them the evil empire. That's where they want you to be through life. That's how they make their money.
Yeah. They understand the psychology of it. You know, it's a vehicle in which to control people, keep them down, keep them oppressed, keep them trapped in their own mind. So they're not ascending to that level where they're healing and they're making their lives the way they want them to be.
So you take these pillars and you start living your life according to these pillars. What else are you doing? What else do you do with it at that point?
So I realize that these things that I'm using in my life are my compass, that are pointing me true north, that are keeping me on the path, that are keeping me in that direction that I need to go in. And I realize that, you know, when I'm not doing these things, I'm falling off the path, or I'm starting to feel really bad again. And it's like BLS before ALS. It's like these things are like, okay, I'm getting confused. I'm getting, you know, anxious. I'm starting to feel the turmoil again. It's like, all right, fall back onto the basics. What are these things that we know fundamentally work every single time, and that if we fall back on, they'll help guide us and mitigate us through that situation.
Right.
So it's like back on the basics. So I fall back on the six pillars every single time. So I put this together, and, you know, I'm at that point again in my career. I'm in it now for 11 years, and I'm like, I want to do more. I want to serve on a higher level. I'm looking around at the culture with the mental health stuff and watching how much people suffer through life, a larger percentage of them because of the career, because of our lack of access to resources, because of our inability to face our fears of judgment from other people and take accountability for our situations. I want to add my value to that somehow.
Right.
So I came up with the title Mindfulness Medic. You know, it's kind of like pays homage to who I am as a paramedic and the mindfulness thing, and realizing that anyone who does these things, you know, they can be a medic too. They can help other people too. They can improve their life with these things. So the Mindfulness Medic just became my way of sharing my journey, sharing my story, sharing my transformation from the person I was, the person I am today, to the person that I'm becoming tomorrow. The Mindfulness Medic became the vehicle that I was sharing this to help try to navigate, to help other people navigate their darkness.
Right.
Because I've been through that darkness. I'm still in that darkness. I'm not better than anyone else. I still have bad days. I still fall off. I still wake up depressed sometimes. I still have fears and doubts. You know, I still got to talk myself into things that I'm afraid of. But I have this vehicle that I use. And that's what I try to share with other people, first responders, people in healthcare, anybody that it resonates with. I have my apparel, the t-shirts, all the designs that I have, they're all focused on some aspect of my journey, my transformation, the six pillars. That's physical representations of my journey.
Yeah.
Things that I'm going through. Just my way of giving back to the community to try to help inspire other first responders to let them know that, you know, it's okay to not be okay, but it's not okay to stay there. You know, that they just fight, if they just take that accountability, that on the other side of that darkness they're experiencing is light, is a life that, you know, you can be happy. It's okay. It's okay to feel joy.
Yeah, I was just about to say that it's not just okay to not be okay, but it's okay to be okay.
Right.
You can get to that spot and be content.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the thing. It's like the roadblock we always have such difficulty with. And again, because back to the childhood stuff, like we don't think we're good enough. We don't think we're deserving of it. We don't think we're good enough to be loved or to feel happiness or to deserve good things in our life. Just recognizing that and realizing that there is this other side of life that you can live. You don't have to be a victim to the darkness. All that dark stuff we experience in this job and in these careers doesn't have to define who we are.
No. No, and it shouldn't, because if it is, then you're just going to live a miserable life. And I think you and I can attest to the fact that in some aspect, the job or outside the job, you know, we've already lived that kind of miserable part of that life. And I don't want to turn back into what it was before I started my journey, you know?
Hmm. Yeah, man. Once you've been there, you don't ever want to go back there again.
And I think I want to hit on that a little bit too. You said, you know, you're not perfect. You're not quote unquote healed. Nobody's healed through all this. Again, I want to reiterate that it's not a linear thing. There's so many ups and downs. It's ridiculous. It's what you do with those ups and downs is the difference.
Exactly. It's a continual evolution. And you know, the more healing and transformation you go through, you just realize that unlocks a whole new level of stuff that you have to deal with now. New fears get unlocked, right?
Yeah.
The more you do and the more you achieve in life, it's just unlocking more stuff you have to deal with.
Yeah.
There's never an end point. There's never a pinnacle.
No.
It's just false peak after false peak. And accepting that and surrendering to that, I think is kind of key to the whole process.
Now, you're the second person today that's brought the word surrender to my table, so. It's interesting.
Took me a long time to realize that. Again, it's not a term we tough and rough types of alpha personalities like to throw around a lot, but you gotta learn to surrender to the process.
Yeah, that surrender is huge. I mean, it's letting go. It's the ability to say, no, I don't have to control everything, but I can control me.
The immediate circle of influence, your thoughts and your actions is where we have control over.
So talk to me about the coaching.
Yeah. So the coaching was just kind of another branch of the Mindfulness Medic. vehicle that I have, my brand, and it's just my way again of trying to help out those individuals that feel that they want to do more, that they're struggling, that they're going through those things in life, and they're just looking for that boost, they're looking for that help, they're looking for that clarity and focus.
Yeah.
Because I know what it's like to just sit there and feel so overwhelmed and not know to where even to start, like how to get that momentum.
Yeah.
It's my way of just trying to give back again to people, first responders, public safety, healthcare. Again, by just sharing my journey, sharing the things that I've learned and the processes that I've used.
Yeah, that deciding when and where to take that first step is the most difficult thing you might ever face.
Yeah. Opening the door for the first time is always the hardest step.
Right.
In anything you do in life.
You know, I talked a little briefly at the beginning where I said, you know, I the show that I released today, and this is, I don't know when our show is going to come out, but the show that I released this morning, I kind of share with the audience the fact that I am stepping aside from the fire department because I've decided that that's the part of my, that's the chapter that needs to kind of close right now or end. And so I can take those next steps, but it's the same thing. Making that decision was not easy. But I had to make a decision and I had to make that first step. And so it's the same thing that you're talking about, where to make that first step. And sometimes you don't even know if it's the right first step. You don't find out till you take it.
Yeah. Just all about trusting the process.
Yeah.
Recognition that on the other side of that fear is where that growth is in life, right?
Yeah, definitely. And hoping that the placing a bet on yourself is the right bet.
Put everything on black, right? Yeah. Hope it works.
Right. So where do you want to take this in the future?
I mean, I'm kind of along that same pathway, I think, too, is, you know, I'm looking around and wanting to evolve this eventually to provide me the opportunity to step away from the fire service and transition to this, you know, as my main purpose in life, because I truly feel this is where I'm the most happy. And serving in that higher level is just trying to help inspire other people, you know?
Right.
A lot like what you've been doing with your podcast and your brand and everything you do. It's just, you find that deep meaning in helping other people alleviate their pain and suffering, right? This next evolution, I think, of guys who realize that, you know, it's okay to step away from the job, that we've done our time. There doesn't need to be some sort of metric we need to fall into for that to be okay, right?
Right.
Like you don't have to put in your 25 years to be considered. Did good job, you know?
Right.
Yeah, eventually I'd like to transition out. Who knows when that'll happen. Right now I'm just enjoying it. I'm trying to just take it day by day. I still love what I do. I still love being in the fire service. Still the greatest job in the world, no matter how much baggage might be attached to it.
Mm-hmm. I don't disagree with that at all. It's a wonderful job. And I wish I had started it as a younger man. Excuse me.
When I was 38.
Yeah. Yeah. I was 44. So I knew there was an expiration date on my time, but I just didn't know what it was. And I set a standard for myself and I don't feel I'm living up to that standard right now. So it's time for me to honor that standard and say, no, enough is enough. I want to pick your brain about a couple of things. And one I might be stepping in it because now that I know that you were a chef at a time, this might be a little dicey, but I want to call you on your chili from yesterday. You said it's the best I'll ever taste. And so somehow we're going to have to set up a challenge because I pride myself on my chili. Cook-off. Yeah.
We'll have to figure out how to do a chili cook-off.
So that's a side note there, but let's talk about Ice Best because that's one of your big presents online is your ice bath.
Yeah. Ice baths have been probably, if I had to say the top three transformative things in my life, was ice baths, jujitsu, and, you know, just the whole mindfulness thing.
So
ice baths.
Yeah. Talk a little bit about it. Why? You know, I know was it based off of Wim Hof or was it something you considered before you got into his studies?
It was mainly driven by Wim Hof. Like just stumbled upon his YouTube stuff back in the day and was like, oh, that's cool. That's interesting. You know, again, listening to his story and then started off with the cold showers at first because Well, that was all I had access to.
Right.
Eventually got into what I have now is just like a stock tank in the wintertime up here in New England. Stays really cold.
Yeah, it does.
But I realized that the cold water was the first thing that I found in my life that actually like switched my brain off.
Mm-hmm.
And it quieted all of those voices and all that static and all that noise and that anxiety. It was like the one place that I found where that just turned off.
Yeah.
Not only that, but getting out and like, well, I feel good. I feel energized. I feel, you know, more in control of my emotions. I feel just kind of more vibrant.
Yeah.
And it's just like this pattern. It's like, okay, I should do this more often. Doing that every day. It's been absolutely transformative for my life.
That discipline of saying, okay, I'm going to do it is massive because you know what's coming. You know the pins and needles it's going to feel like when you get in there and the involuntary shivers that you have, like I said, they're involuntary. You don't have control over them really. And you're going to find your spot where maybe you get control of them briefly, but they're there and you have to work on it. But that it does, you know, yesterday I was walking around and in my head I was going, I can't control everything that's going on in my head. I've got so much going on and I just said, you know, it's time. I got to get in. I don't know what the temperature is out there. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. What I have to do is what I have to do. And as soon as I hit that water, you're right. My brain went poof and it just kind of relaxed.
It's incredible the effects it has. In the same way, it's that friction your mind goes through to get in and it's there no matter what, no matter how many times you've done it.
Yeah.
Every single time before you get in, you're like, oh God, you're trying to make all these, your brain makes all these excuses on why you shouldn't. Like, oh, I'll just stay inside, do it tomorrow.
Yeah.
You don't need one today.
Right. No, it's raining. Like, why would I go out in the rain? Yeah. Whatever it is.
Right.
Yeah.
I'll be grumping through the house or I'll be in a mood and Angela, my wife, will just look at me. She's like, you need to go get in the ice. All right. You're right.
Yeah. It's invaluable. I'm not on an everyday schedule, but I'm definitely on one of those schedules where I recognize when I need to do it. And maybe for me, it's something that I need to start doing on an everyday schedule. I don't know. I'm incorporating some sauna time and some ice time and trying to get at least one of them each day.
Dude, that's so pivotal though. Cause it's like, that's the conscious awareness of your situation.
Yeah.
When we start to recognize like, oh, hey, I need this modality in my life. That's huge. And that's a place a lot of people don't even get to. And I think that's amazing when people say that. They're like, yeah, I realize that it's time for me to switch on to this thing that I know that helps me.
Yeah.
So it's huge in people's healing and growth when they're able to get to that point in their life.
So where do you hope to take it? You know, you said you want to be able to maybe step away from the fire service eventually, but now I'm thinking, I don't know, what do you want to do with it when you do step away from the fire service? You want it to be like, are you going to garner a following and go on the road, that kind of thing? Or is it going to be some kind of workshops? Is it just going to be coaching? Are you going to get into more of a counseling track where you kind of go back to school for something? What are you thinking?
Yeah. I mean, I'd like to grow the apparel brand, obviously. Just grow that into a big thing. And, you know, through that, kind of like all of the things that interest me with the ice baths and jujitsu and tie everything together into this lifestyle brand that explains that story and that transformation and how that ties into first responders and mental health awareness and trying to improve people's lives. And then in growing the coaching side of things where I can bring that impact to people's lives directly, whether through personal coaching or group coaching, you know, eventually building that side of it.
Right.
And then, yeah, maybe getting involved into going to departments and sharing that stuff and, you know, trying to just that grassroots effort into trying to change the culture. Because I realized that, you know, I don't think we're ever going to be able to change the main culture as it is, right?
Mm-hmm.
So deeply rooted in tradition. Frankly, you know, a lot of dogmatic mentality. I think the only way to do it is to create a subculture within the culture. That's like that old school punk rock
mentality
that I have, you know, those roots. You got to create that anti-culture.
Kind of a guerrilla mindfulness.
Right? I like that. That's good. So yeah, just bring it to departments if they're interested, and just talk to the people that are suffering from it, that want to talk about it.
Yeah. Yeah. We need to talk a little more offline then. First of all, I want to give you your chance. If there's anything you want to expand on or add, go for it. I don't want to cut you off at any certain time, but I want to make sure that we don't spend forever here. You know, I know you have a day to get about. So is there anything you wanted to expand on or add to what we just discussed?
No, I think that pretty much covers it. I just have a really deeply intrinsic desire to see people better themselves, because I know firsthand what it's like, and it sucks.
Yeah.
And I hate to see guys struggle. I hate to see people struggle with PTSD and the darkness and vices and the addictions. I have people reach out to me, you know, through direct messages, and they're like, hey, what you're doing really means a lot. This is inspiring. But, you know, the common thread that I'm finding in people is just they don't know where to start.
Yeah.
I just want people to realize that it's okay to feel the way they're feeling, but they got to fight. Got to do something about the level of PTSD and the rates of suicide in our profession. There's got to be something done about it.
Yeah.
And all I'm trying to do is add just a little bit of value to that. You know, if I can impact just one person's life, to inspire one person, I'll consider my job done.
So let's get to my last two questions. And I told you I was going to spring a surprise on you because nobody's really heard what I'm trying to change to. I used to ask about an everyday carry all the time. And I got a lot of repetitive answers, and it was one of those things where I was like, okay, yep, I got it. So somebody posted a question. What's that?
That one would have been easy.
Couple. There you go. So someone posted a question. I asked for writing prompts one day on Instagram when I did a question on a broadcast channel. And I just said, hey, what writing prompt do you have for me? And I'm going to get around to doing some writing on those prompts. But one of the questions was, when was the last time you felt a sense of awe? And I thought to myself, I said, God damn, that's a tough one. You know, for me, I had to really sit with it a little bit. And I think there's some answers there. And I kind of want to get, you know, my guests and those views that they have on it. When was the last time you felt a sense of awe?
That's a good question. There was a moment a couple weeks ago where my son was talking, and we were just sitting as a family at the dinner table, and I was just looking at him talk, and it just like, it hit me. As a human, with all of these feelings and all of these deep rooted emotions in like all of this future ahead of him. And I just, for the first time, I was like, just listening to him and yeah, we made him. He's real. He's right in front of us. And it's like all these big emotions, like, man, like everything I do, everything I say is essentially becoming the blueprint of who he becomes.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, again, after I'd been doing some of this therapy lately, and I was like opening up to just like how much we affect kids because they're watching us all the time, listening to everything we say, and just coming to that realization, like, wow, there's a lot of responsibility there.
Yeah. Wait till those kids are adults and they have kids and you hold your grandchild for the first time and you realize that, holy shit, this is not just my child. Now it's a legacy.
Right. That's wild, dude.
Yeah. Yeah. Now you're holding your legacy in your hands and it'll blow you away.
That's deep.
Yeah. So get ready for that one. That one will hit you differently. So not to steal thunder, but goddamn, you're right. Man, when you look at those kids, and when my kids were little and I sat across from them at a table, I was like, I did that. That's part of me.
Ever.
Yeah.
So easy to get distracted and to just like to be busy all the time. I'm really trying to stay mindful of that, you know, and to not say no. Because I grew up with that. It's rough. Like, go play catch when they ask.
Yeah.
Go play dolls and dress up when she asks, you know?
Yeah. Let her paint your fingernails. It's okay.
Right. Because we don't get that time back in it. It's so cliche, but it goes by so fast.
It does. It does. It truly does. So soak it in and enjoy it. All right. Let's talk about books. What do you got for me?
Books. Current read I'm reading is a book called Love Without Conditions.
Okay.
This is an amazing book written by Paul Ferrini. All about just accepting those things in life, you know, that you're worthy of love, and that's the whole point. One of my favorite books is The Alchemist.
Oh, hell yeah.
My Life Forever.
Yeah. That's one of my favorites.
A lot of my belief systems.
Yeah.
We got the old tried and true. Work agreements, that's a good one.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I could go on.
Yeah, no.
Big Leap, that's a good one.
The Alchemist is one of those that I suggest to people, and I'm more than willing to buy someone a copy of it so they can read it.
I've read it 3 times now, and I'm still picking things out of it.
Yeah.
It's such a good book.
Yeah, I was introduced to it when I was in undergrad school in Kansas State, and it was part of a literature class that I took, and I came in with this notion that it's whatever, it's a book. And I read that and a couple others in that class. And I was like, holy shit, there's a difference between a novel and a book. And what he does in that novel is, yeah, he'll teach you for life.
I was introduced to it by my personal development coach who, you know, preached on it a lot for a couple of years. And I finally picked it up.
Yeah. Very cool, man. I appreciate the time. I appreciate the suggestions and the words of wisdom. Thanks for coming on. Thanks for being a guest. And thanks for just doing what you do.
I appreciate it, man. Thanks for the opportunity.
And I'm going to say we're out here.
Thanks for listening to another episode of The Things We All Carry. Head over to the website, thethingsweallcarry.com, for show notes, resources, and to sign up for the newsletter. Until next week, take care of yourselves and remember to check in on each other.